Go to our text this evening then. We're in 1 Kings chapter 3. Taking a look at Solomon's reign. I better put this over here, because if I keep putting it on there, it's going to turn buttons and all kinds of craziness. So. All right. Last week, we looked at the passage in the beginning of 1 Kings chapter 3 where Solomon petitioned the Lord for his blessing upon his kingdom, and the Lord answered in a dream, asked Solomon that question, "What do you want?" Solomon replied by asking for wisdom, and God was very, very pleased with that request. Since Solomon didn't ask for great riches or long life for himself or for the life of his enemies, then God granted him both wisdom and riches and told Solomon that if you're obedient, then you will have long life. That one was conditional. The other two were going to happen no matter what. And so we get into the middle part of chapter 3, and Solomon's going to respond to that, and we're going to see an example of God's answer to that prayer. So the two parts of Solomon's request, well, I should say the two parts of God's answer, were wisdom and riches. Those are things that God promised he would deliver to Solomon. So we're going to see the wisdom of Solomon interwoven throughout his life story. Much of the riches part are going to be described in detail in chapter 4. But we get one example immediately of Solomon's wisdom in verse 16. After Solomon went and worshipped the Lord both at Shiloh, where the tabernacle was, and in Jerusalem, where the Ark of the Covenant was, we get this account starting in verse 16. Two prostitutes came to the king and stood before him. And the one woman said, "Oh, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. Then, on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth, and we were alone. There was no one else with us in the house. Only we two were in the house." That's an important detail. Gets repeated about three times because of what's going to happen. So, there's a saying when you're doing hearing a case, whether it be in court or in a counseling session or just trying to solve problems, the first person that comes to you always seems right until you have a chance to cross-examine, right? So maybe you guys had this as you're raising your kids and they would come in and, "Mom, so-and-so did this to me." And you think, "Wow, that's a really terrible thing." And then you ask the other child what happened. It's never the same, is it? All right. People tend to color the accounts of what happened to them according to their own perceptions, so it's not always accurate to listen just to the first person. Well, Solomon's going to display some wisdom here in his listening, but the fact that these two gals were the only two gals in the house is important also because of what's going to happen. Verse 19, "This woman's son died in the night because she lay on him." Well, then why does it become important to note that they were alone in the house? Well, there's no witnesses for one thing, yep. And it also shows that nobody else killed the baby. So you both go to sleep at night, you wake up in the morning, and one of the children is dead because it's been smothered. That would be pretty abundantly clear because mom wakes up in the morning, she's laying on top of the baby, and the baby is dead. Well, I guess she didn't wake up in the morning, did she? We'll see what else goes on here. Verse 20, "She arose at midnight, took my son from beside me while your servant slept, and laid him at her breast, and laid her dead son at my breast." So she switched the children. "When I rose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him closely in the morning, behold, he was not the child that I had born." But the other woman said, "No, the living child is mine, and the dead child is yours." And the first said, "No, the dead child is yours, and the living child is mine." And thus they spoke before the king. So here's the presentation of the problem. Two prostitutes come in. So they're pregnant, or they were pregnant. They've given birth. And folks, we got to understand, the evils that we see in our society today are not new. Everything that's coming about today, even though we hate to see it coming in American culture, because for 250 years almost, this has been a nation that has largely been built on God's rule. Not totally, but largely. Most people in the United States have had some kind of Christian background until recently. This generation that is coming of age right now is going to be the first mostly unchurched generation in the history of the country. And that's having its effects, isn't it? So we're seeing all sorts of social difficulties come up. We're seeing mindsets change. All the statistics now tell us that the majority of people in the United States, including those within the church, are on board with homosexual marriage, think there's nothing wrong with cohabiting before marriage. Adultery is kind of, well, you know, it's not great, but not really a big deal either. Abortion is necessary to allow it. Most people think abortion is not a good thing, but they think it's necessary to allow it. So we see the fact that a lack of biblical understanding has really permeated our culture to the point that our social norms no longer reflect biblical values. That's not new. It's new for us as Americans, again, because of our history, that for 250 years we've largely been a nation built on God's word. But as far as the history of the world goes, this isn't new. People have been cohabiting before marriage long before America was here. People have been committing adultery long before America was here. People have been engaging in homosexual behavior and in other forms of gross sexual immorality long before America was here. So these things are not new. And in fact, we see right here, they were a part of Solomon's great kingdom. These sorts of things happen. So I say all that only to say, not that we should accept these things and be good with them, but that we shouldn't let the shock factor get us. Right? So we understand people are sinful. They're going to act in sinful ways, and we don't expect unsaved, sinful people to act like saints. They're simply not going to. And so that can help us as we approach them with the gospel message that we want to present sin as sin, but we also want to be careful that we don't come across as just being jerks and holier than thou, right? So that's not a greatly worded, I'll admit, defense of the subject, but there it is. You have it in all of its lack of glory. So the two prostitutes, they come before him. They're both pregnant right about the same time, and they both give birth very close, 3 days apart. So what happens is on the third day, they go to bed at night, and they would typically just lay down right next to the baby. They didn't have cribs in separate rooms and baby monitors and all those things. And so they would lay right next to the baby. And they would lay it really in such a way that if the baby awoke and was hungry, it could nurse while the mom was sleeping. And that's just the way it did. They didn't worry too much about rolling over on them, but it did happen occasionally. And so here they lay down on their beds at night, and they lay with their children next to them. I heard a story of a missionary one time. This is completely off the topic. Well, it's not completely off topic, but I heard a story of a missionary one time. So an American missionary went over to another country, and they got their house, and they put their children in one bedroom, and they, of course, set up in another bedroom, because that's how we as Americans do it, isn't it? We usually have separate rooms for us and for our kids. And some of their people came in to visit them and noticed the setup, looked at the missionaries and said, don't you love your children? Well, of course we love our children. What do you mean? So why would you make them sleep all the way on the other end of the house? And because in that culture, they all slept in one room. And so we would look at it and say, well, you got to have separate rooms, right? Not necessarily, right? So different ways of doing things. So there you see, neither here nor there. They go to bed, and when the first woman wakes up in the morning, she looks at her son and realizes, wait a second, this isn't my baby. Ever heard anybody say all children, all babies look alike? Moms, do all babies look alike? Not a chance, do they? You know the difference between your baby and somebody else's baby, don't you? Because you're intimately connected with that child. So it's one of these things that it's almost unbelievable to us that somebody would try this. But, hey, this is what sinful people do. They try these sorts of things. So woman A, we don't even get the names of these ladies. Woman A wakes up in the morning, and this is not her baby. She goes to nurse it, and it's not hers. Well, the only other person in the house is woman B. She's got a live baby. I've got a dead baby that I know isn't mine. Wait a second, that baby over there is mine. Well, I can't force her. I don't have the physical strength. These two gals probably had some kind of falling out, you can imagine. There was a big skerfuffle, I would guess. But eventually, this works its way up to where they decide the only way to settle this matter is to take it before the Supreme Court of Israel, who also happens to be the King of Israel, who also happens to be the legislature of Israel. Okay, wasn't any separation of powers back then. And so they bring this before the king, and they present the problem. Now, the difficulty gets into, they both are saying, no, that's my baby. No, that's my baby. No, that's my baby. Solomon has to make a decision here because that's what the king does. He dispenses justice. Now, also understand, there was a tiered system of judicial courts, right? Just like we have. We have local courts, and then we have district courts, and then we have the Supreme Court above all of them. And so what can't get decided at the lower level goes up to the next one. So they would have had a local elder board, probably, that would have looked into this matter and said, I can't tell which of these women is lying and which is telling the truth. Because obviously, if you don't know them to just look at the baby, how would you know which baby belongs to which woman? Probably wouldn't. And since there's no father in the picture, they're both prostitutes. Well, the father's probably around, but he probably doesn't want to show his face, right? And so there's no father in there to step in and bear witness to anything. So you just have the word of one prostitute against the word of another prostitute. And they can't solve the matter. So it goes up all the way through the chain of courts to the Supreme Court, which is Solomon, and they bring this to him. Probably some amount of time has passed, and so this child is not a three-day-old infant anymore. It has been living and growing, probably in the custody of the second woman. And she's been nursing it, she's been taking care of it, and here you finally get them before. So how do you decide which of these two women is telling the truth? Tim, you've got a little detective kit at home. Would this help you at all? It can't do DNA tests? Can't do blood tests? No. Now, today, obviously, we would have those means available to us. We're going to check DNA, and that's going to definitively tell us which mother this baby belongs to. But Solomon doesn't have that tool available to him, so he has to reason through this using the wisdom that God's given him. Now, the test that he comes up with is one that probably most of us would either never come up with on our own or never have the gall to actually bring up, right? So here's what it is, and I want you to think through this test and tell me, what is he counting on to solve the problem, right?
That they're the same race.
That they're the same race? All right. So the king, first of all, he's going to acknowledge the difficulty of deciding who's telling the truth. The king said, this one says, this is my son that is alive, and your son is dead. And the other says, no, but your son is dead, and my son is the living one. How do you decide between the two when there's no witnesses and there's no way to gather any evidence to the contrary? So, the principle of justice, let's think about that. If the king is supposed to deliver justice, if it were a murder trial, the principle of justice would obviously be that the murderer needs to be found guilty and then punished for the crime, right? If it were a theft trial, then the thief would have to be recognized and make restitution by repaying fourfold what he had stolen. If it were a trial of I injured somebody, then if it was proved that I did the injuring, then I'd be liable to pay for medical care and recuperation fees and those things, right? So what is the principle of justice that needs to be executed here? What would make this right? What's that? Well, God's going to be the one that makes it right. Yeah, but what principle does Solomon have to institute in order to rectify this situation? The real mother gets the baby. Parental rights. Yeah? Parental rights important? Absolutely. Our country's actually pretty good at recognizing parental rights. Not in every case, but in most cases, our Supreme Court and our laws have always upheld that parents have the right to direct the upbringing of their children in almost every way. It is what's called a fundamental right. It's not an absolute right, but it's a fundamental right. Okay? The difference being, an absolute right, there's no way you can take it away. There's nothing you can do. So an absolute right, I can exercise in any way I want to, and nobody can do anything about it, right? So do I have some limitations upon myself as a father in what rights I can exercise towards my kids? Yeah, I don't have the right to hurt them, do I? I don't have the right to abuse them or to kill them. Under Roman law, Dad had that right. He had the absolute right of the father. He could have his kids executed and the law would say nothing about it. Okay? But Solomon is recognizing here that God is the one who has created parental rights. Who created parents? God did. Who created children? God did. To whom did God give children? To their parents. So we look to those things and say, God is the one that has instituted, created, and upholds parental rights. They are very important. And in fact, all throughout the law and through the New Testament as well, the direction and responsibility for rearing children falls on mom and dad as an exercise of parental rights. Parental rights are not just privileges, they are responsibilities. So God grants me children and then tasks me with the responsibility to raise them for Him and to care for them and to make sure that I'm constantly trying to point their hearts back to Him. Read Deuteronomy 6. That's where it talks about when you rise up and when you lay down and when you're going about the way, you're talking about the law of God to your children. Read Ephesians chapter 6, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath, but raise them in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Those are very, very important parts of parental rights. So Solomon, in order to execute justice in this case, needs to make sure the child gets back to its mother, because she has the right to that baby, and she has the responsibility to that baby. So if Solomon is going to be a just king, he has to make sure justice is accomplished. So he acknowledges the problem here. How do I decide which one of you is lying? And the king said, bring me a sword. So a sword was brought before the king. I just would love to see these gals' faces at this point. What is he doing? Is he going to execute us because he's annoyed with us? You know, some kings might do that. The king said, bring me a sword. So a sword was brought before the king. And the king said, divide the living child in two. Give half to the one and half to the other. Yuck. That would be one way to solve the problem, I guess. Now understand, I don't think Solomon has any intention of actually carrying this out, because he would know the child hasn't done anything wrong. It doesn't deserve to die, does it? What principle is he playing on here to bring the truth out? A mama's heart. So here's Solomon's wisdom being displayed. Solomon understands human nature. He understands a mama's affection for her babies. He understands that a sweet, gentle woman can be turned into a mama bear in regards to her kids, right? Don't mess with my babies. Oh, we've all seen it happen. Okay, so he threatens the child, I'm going to cut it in half and we'll split it up. That sounds fair. That sounds like a man's solution to a problem too, doesn't it? Yeah, I don't know. Let's just do this. Okay. Then the woman whose son was alive said to the king, because her heart yearned for her son, oh my lord, give her the living child and by no means put him to death. So here, this gal, whose son it is, and she knows it's her son, and the other woman knows it's her son. She says, I'd rather be deprived of him, of taking care of him, than have him dead. And that's a mother's heart for her kids. Just protect them. Whatever's going to protect their life and well-being. Just, okay, just let him live. Don't kill him. Give him to her. And of course, the other woman, who has no connection to this child, and if you say, if she cared this little about the kid, why did she take him in the first place? What does she want this child for? And she obviously doesn't care much about him, because her response is, he shall be neither mine nor yours. Divide him. What are you going to do with half a baby? I mean, here's part of the sadness of it. We have later in Scripture some accounts of women giving birth and eating their children. We don't want to ignore the fact that many people throughout the ancient world lived in terrible poverty and took extreme measures. Now, that measure of eating children was during the siege of Jerusalem, so it was a pretty extreme situation. But what does this girl want with half a baby? Is that what she's planning on doing? I'll just eat the kid? That saves me meal money and saves me the upkeep of a kid for the next 20 years? We don't know, but for whatever reason, because she's not his mother, she's willing to see him killed. She's willing to see him split up so she can at least get some gain out of it, whatever gain that might be. Well, obviously, the compassion of the real mother is contrasted with the lack of compassion of the other mother. So the king, verse 27, answered and said, "Give the living child to the first woman. By no means put him to death, since she is his mother." That's definitively been answered. Because Solomon recognizes this about human nature, that mothers protect their children at all costs. And mothers don't protect other people's children at all costs. Now, they will protect them, but not at all costs. And so all Israel heard the judgment of the king that he had rendered, and they stood in awe of the king because they perceived that the wisdom of God was in him to do justice. So Solomon was able to discern what's true, and he was able to apply his understanding of human nature in order to accomplish a just principle, which is parental rights. He was able to put things back the way that they should have been. I've got a little video I'm going to use to illustrate this for you. It's only about a minute long, but it's lots of fun. This is a video that Daniel made about both of these accounts. Ethan, are we on sound? I think he hooked us up anyway. We have no sound, Ethan. Ethan, you've got the wrong one on. You plugged it into this other one?
Yeah, I've got all of them on.
You've got all of them on. Did I shut the sound off? I did not. My sound is on. Okay.
God, please give me wisdom to govern your people. Solomon. Because you ask for wisdom and not self-gain, I give you greater wisdom, greater than anyone else. I also give you great riches, that Israel may be greater than any of the nations around it. Thank you, Lord, for the wisdom. Thank you. Thank you, God. Thank you.
My king, we both live in the same house. I gave birth and 3 days later she did. Her son died at night and she took my son. Your son is dead. That wasn't my son.
Bring me a sword. Divide the child between them both.
Give the child to her, but do not kill him. Divide him.
You are the real mother.
Speech, Daniel. There you go. Solomon's great wisdom. All right. Well, let's go ahead and start into the next chapter, too. That account that we just looked at was an example of Solomon's wisdom. It was a fulfillment of God's promise to grant Solomon great wisdom. We're going to see his great wisdom as it comes out in some other things as well. But this next chapter, beginning in chapter 4, is going to be a kingdom like no other. And it's going to be seeing how God fulfills his promise to make Israel a great nation and to make it a prosperous nation. It's going to be a little bit of an academic treatment because there's a lot of names, a lot of locations listed, and there's not a whole lot of application to us in this time. But it's background information that'll be very important later on as we study Solomon's life. So chapter 4, verse 1, Solomon was king over all Israel, and these were his high officials. Yeah, I don't know if you remember back to 2 Samuel chapter 8. When David was established as the king, we had a very similar account that listed David's officials, and we spent some time in that. We had one at the beginning of his reign. We had one at the end of his reign. We're only going to get one list here from Solomon's reign in the beginning. But this is going to be a summary of the official positions that his kingdom filled out. So the first name mentioned there is Azariah, the son of Zadok, who was the priest. Now, first off, this is probably not talking about the priest of the temple, because just in a couple of verses, we're going to be seeing that Zadok and Abiathar were still functioning as the high priests. That term priest can also be used of a counselor to the king. And in fact, the way the Hebrew is written, it has the definite article the in front of it, so it's the priest. And probably is signifying one of the very close counselors of the king, or the king's most trusted counselor. I want you to turn back to 2 Samuel chapter 8 real quickly. I'm going to compare these two lists for you, at least in one point, because there's something very interesting here. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 15. 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 15. Still hear a few pages turning. All right, 2 Samuel 8:15. So David ruled over all Israel, and David administered justice and equity to all his people. Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. I'm going to pause right there because I want to draw a contrast. Who was the first listed official in David's kingdom? Joab, the commander of the army. Who is the first listed official in Solomon's kingdom? Yeah, Azariah, the son of Zadok, the king's counselor, or the priest, right? Why the difference? Why do you think David's kingdom, the chief guy, was the commander of the army, and in Solomon's kingdom, the chief guy is a counselor? Gene? David was a king of war. A lot of his reign was dedicated to securing the borders and expanding the influence of Israel's military machine. David fought a lot of wars, so that makes sense that the chief person in David's cabinet would be Joab, the commander of the army. Because whose advice do you need most of all when you're involved in a lot of war? You need your commander of your armies. Solomon's kingdom fought very few wars. And so the commander of his army doesn't line up as the head of his cabinet, but instead a counselor does. That's also displaying the wisdom of Solomon's kingdom. It wasn't a kingdom that was going to be maintained and built with the sword. Now, don't mistake this. Solomon's kingdom is a military powerhouse. But the chief of his cabinet, the chief of his leaders, is a counselor, not a warrior. So that's the first person mentioned. Verse 3, Elihoreph and Ahijah, the sons of Shisha, were secretaries. These are just people keeping records, right? Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Now here's a little interesting tidbit. If you still have your finger in 2 Samuel, then jump back there real quick and look at the next name after Joab. Verse 16, Joab, the son of Zeruiah, was over the army. And what's the next name? Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud. And what was he doing? He's the recorder. So Solomon carries the same guy over from his dad's kingdom and keeps him in the same position. So this must have been a pretty trustworthy guy if he's able to stay in this position and continue on. He also probably served till very, very late in his life, because if he was recorder for much of David's kingdom and he's still recorder in Solomon's kingdom, he's got a lot of experience, right? So that's the second person is the, the third, Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was recorder. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the army. Now this is where we see Joab's position filled, because what happened to Joab? He was executed for murdering two people. Solomon had him executed. Well, somebody's got to fill that position. Another interesting little tidbit, Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, also appears in David's cabinet. He is called the commander of the Kelethites and the Pelethites, and they were David's personal bodyguard. So this man who was in charge of David's most loyal elite troops is now commanding the entire army under Solomon. So that's another point of continuity between David's kingdom and Solomon's kingdom. Zadok and Abiathar were priests. So here is probably the distinction we have of the high priests organizing the worship of Jehovah in the tabernacle and in the tent where the Ark of the Covenant was. But what happened to Abiathar? What did Solomon do with Abiathar?
He exiled him,
told him, go home. It's a forced retirement. You're done serving as a high priest, so go back to Anathoth and live there on your land. Because Abiathar sided with Solomon's brother when he tried to take the throne, right? And so Abiathar was exiled and sent home. Not necessarily exiled, I guess. He had the freedom to be able to move around, but he was forced into retirement from the high priesthood. So he's recorded here probably as a matter of honor, just because it was such a an honorable position to hold the title of high priest, that it's sort of like you're gonna be a high priest your whole life, even if you're not serving as high priest at the time. What do they call that?
Emeritus.
He's high priest emeritus now. So he's home at Anathoth. He's not functioning as high priest, but he is still high priest. So Azariah, the son of Nathan, was over the officers. We're not sure there if that's Nathan the prophet or if it's some other Nathan. There are a lot of Nathans in the Bible, including the next verse, Zabad, the son of Nathan, was priest and king's friend. Once again there, that term priest is probably being used in the terms of a counselor to the king because of what follows, king's friend. That was a position sort of like the best man at your wedding. He's the guy that's going to help you do everything. So the king's friend was a very close advisor, confidant, and a right-hand man to the king. So it's very possible also that that Nathan spoken of there is David's uncle, which would make this king's friend, would make Zabad Solomon's cousin. And so possible. Not sure there, but possible. Abishar was in charge of the palace, and Adoniram, the son of Abda, was in charge of the forced labor. Verse 7, Solomon had 12 officers over all Israel who provided food for the king and his household. Each man had to make provision for 1 month in the year. Now understand, that's not each man out of his own pocket. These were tax collectors. So each of them had 1 month that they were assigned to provide the needs for Solomon's royal court. And it was divided up that way. So they were to collect income from the area over which they presided, and it was supposed to be enough to provide for King Solomon's palace for 1 month out of the year. And so that's the system that he established here, and it's going to give us a list of them. These were their names: Ben-Hur, not the movie, Ben-Hur in the hill country of Ephraim. So I have our map up here so that I can help us see where some of these areas are. There's a lot of text on here from these names, but if you can see, Jerusalem is right there where the hand is at, and Ephraim is this area just north and west of Jerusalem. So this is the hill country of Ephraim, and this is where Ben-Hur was in charge of. Next was Ben-Decker in Makaz, Shealbim and Beth-Shemesh, and Elbanath-Hanan. Beth-Shemesh is right down here. So it is, here's Ephraim, here's Beth-Shemesh. So you're moving southward. This little area would be what the second man was in charge of, Ben-Decker. Verse 10, Ben-Chesed in Araboth, to him belonged Sokah and all the land of Hefer. Sokah is just a little bit farther south. So you can see we start here in Ephraim and we're moving southward through Judah. So the third man has control of Sokah and all this region in southern Judah. This would have been very familiar stuff to David because this is where he spent much of his time running away from Saul down in this area of the country. Verse 11, Ben-Abinadab in all Naphath-Dor, he had Taphath and the daughter of Solomon as his wife. We don't have any indication where these towns are at. We're not sure which area we're talking about, but it seems like we're kind of moving in a counterclockwise direction, but we're just not sure. But the little tidbit we find out about this guy is that he's a son-in-law to the king. Probably then we're talking about later in Solomon's kingdom where this guy comes into play, because as we've learned, Solomon was probably 19 or 20 years old when he took the throne. And so it would have taken time for him to rear a daughter to the point that he would give her off in marriage to this guy. So this list of officials may have been something that was developed halfway through Solomon's reign, or maybe a little bit farther. But this man marries Solomon's daughter. Verse 12, Baana, the son of Ahilud, in Tanakh, Megiddo, and all Beth-shean that is beside Zarethan below Jezreel, and from Beth-shean to Abel-Meholah as far as the other side of Jokmeam. Got all that? So, joking around in Sunday school this morning, you know, being the new guy in some of the towns I've been in, as we move around from pastoring to pastoring, we get directions from people quite a bit. And how often the directions were, turn left at the building that used to be the Piggly Wiggly. Well, now it's burnt down. It's not there anymore. You know, we'll say, well, how am I supposed to know where that building is at? But you know, those are some of the directions we get. It's what I feel like when we're reading through these. Like, where, Jokmeam? Where is that at? Right. But some of those terms we know. Right here is the Jezreel Valley. It's a valley that runs from the Mediterranean Sea here all the way down to the Jordan River Valley over here. And Beth-shean is right there. And so the area that we're talking about is this area over here south of Jezreel. There's Taanach, there's Beth-shean. And so this guy is concerned with this area here just south of Jezreel. Where'd I go? Lost it. Verse 13. Ben-Geber in Ramoth-Gilead, he had the villages of Jair, the son of Manasseh, which are in Gilead, and he had the region of Argob, which is in Bashan, 60 great cities with walls and bronze bars. So Argob is this area up here, Ramoth-Gilead over here. So now we're talking about this easternmost portion of the nation of Israel. I'm going to zoom out just a little bit. So here again is Argob and Ramoth-Gilead. If you go much farther to the east, you're getting into the Arabian Desert. So these areas were just about the border of Israel. Beyond that, not too many people lived except for some of the wandering nomadic people of Aram. But it was all desert land, very difficult to cross. So we're talking now about this area on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Verse 14, Ahinadab, the son of Iddo, in Mahanaim. Mahanaim we've heard about before. This is where David fled from Absalom. So we're talking about this central region on the east side of the Jordan River. Verse 15, Ahimaaz in Naphtali, he had taken Basemath, the daughter of Solomon, his wife. So here we've got another son-in-law of Solomon. And Naphtali is this area up here around the Sea of Galilee. Baana, the son of Hushai in Asher and Bealoth, once again up in this area. Jehoshaphat, the son of Parua in Issachar, also up here, just a little bit farther south. Issachar is down this way. And Shimei, the son of Elah, in Benjamin. Now Benjamin's getting back down here between Judah and Ephraim again. Geber, the son of Uri, in the land of Gilead, which is also over here. The country of Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and of Og, the king of Bashan. Now Sihon, the king of the Amorites, and Og, the king of Bashan, have been dead for 400 years. But it was still known as their land. How's that for a legacy? Right? It is the area over here just north of Moab. It's an area the Israelites conquered from Sihon and Og before they crossed the Jordan River into the land of Canaan. So this is the area that we're talking about there. And there was one governor who was over the land. So there's a real brief description of how Solomon ordered his Internal Revenue Service. And it was divide the country up into 12 sections, 12 regions, and each of those 12 would be responsible to provide the royal court with all of its food and sustenance for 1 month at a time. Next week we'll take a look at what that sustenance looked like. And might be surprising, It's probably a little above the order of food and money that one of our households uses in a month, right? So, once again, a lot of academic stuff, geographical, political, looking at those things, but very important to understand just how God was allowing Solomon to put this kingdom together in order to demonstrate the blessings of a wise king. Any questions?